Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
Jesse Clegg is a platinum-selling South African singer-songwriter with 5 South African Music Award nominations. His albums include When I Wake Up in 2008, Life on Mars, a collaboration with Grammy-winning Canadian producer David Bottrell in 2011, and Things Unseen in 2016. Since 2016, he has consistently released charting singles every year, and he is currently recording his 4th album. Jesse's extensive touring in South Africa, as well as shows in the US and UK, including performances at the famous Isle of Wight Festival and Radio City Music Hall in New York City, has solidified his reputation as a captivating and dynamic live performer. He's been the main support act for several international tours, including Joan Armour Trading, Daughtry, and Imagine Dragons. Jesse has collaborated with a premium list of artists, including Shekinah, Walk the Moon, Msaki, Kent Phonik, Autumn Rowe, and DJ Kent. Jesse's most popular singles include Let It Burn, Speed of Light, Waiting on the Outcome, Today, Use Me, Breathing featuring Shekinah, and recently Called to Hear Your Voice. He also featured and co-wrote the hit single Fire in Your House by US pop group Walk the Moon. Jesse shared the stage with his father Johnny Clegg in 2016, and they subsequently performed 3 world tours together. In 2018, Jesse co-wrote and executive produced his father's final album, King of Time. Up next on Celeb Savant, live in studio at Solid Gold Podcasts in Randburg, Johannesburg, South Africa, is Jesse Clegg. And joining me today, we have got Jesse Clegg.
Thank you, man. Great to be here.
Yes, it's been a determination of mine to get you on the show, so I'm very grateful that you're here, so thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, man. It's great to finally be here.
Yes. So, Jesse, let's rewind. At what age, whether as a child or teenager, did you think, cool, you want to be in the creative world, the creative space, and how did that journey progress to where we are today?
Well, music was so omnipotent in my household, obviously.
Naturally.
You know, my dad was a professional musician touring 6 to 9 months of the year. So from birth, basically, I was just, you know, I just got to see and feel and hear so much music and the life that unfolds as a musician. I was kind of a passenger on that. So, you know, it's always been part of my life, and it was very inspiring growing up in that environment. I got to see different places in the world and travel and hear music in different languages and different cultures. And it was just such a portal to new experiences and new feelings and new things. And so I think that it's always been a love of mine. I was singing and dancing from, you know, when I was a baby, basically. I also, like, I think, you know, growing up in that, you also get to see, like, the sort of unglamorous side, like the discipline. And, you know, my dad was away for many, many months. And, you know, I also got to see the challenges of being a lifelong artist. So I was like, I loved music, and I wasn't, but I didn't feel immediately confident that I was going to be a musician. I think it was really when I started like writing music, like probably like early teens, that I like picked up guitar and, like, you know, I wasn't just playing covers of other people's songs. I was actually like writing my own music, and I realized that this is more than just a way to access the music that I love and the artists that I love. This is actually a language that I can learn how to speak. And once I started doing that, something unlocked for me. And I had the feeling that, like, I would always be writing songs, whether I was going to be a professional musician or not, I didn't know. But I always had this feeling that, like, this was going to be a part of my life. So, yeah, I'd say, like, that kind of time, like 12, 13, I really, like, fell in love with it.
Okay, so you said that you observed the challenges that, you know, of your father being a lifelong performer. So for the listeners who do not know, who think it's just glamorous and all sparkly lights and glitter balls or whatever, what challenges are there that people don't necessarily know about?
Obviously, there's so much traveling, you know, and traveling sounds great on paper.
Yes.
But when you're traveling for tour or for music or for any kind of work, really, you know, you're not traveling to experience the place necessarily. You're traveling you know, like I've been to so many different countries and I've, you know, I've traveled America, I've traveled Europe, but I don't feel like I've really seen those places. I've seen the venue and the street that the venue's on.
Yes.
Like that's my experience. And then the audience, you know, the audience is really your deepest sort of cultural experience of a place. But it's long time, it's long periods away from home. You know, there's also the challenge of like constantly trying to create and do something new. And every time I release a song, every time I write something and put it out, there's this, you know, it's a piece of yourself and there's this vulnerability and there's this emotional weight that you attach to it. And that can be quite a sort of stormy experience. You know, like, you know, so much of the music that songwriters write is deeply connected to their own life and memories and emotions. And so, you know, you're mining through that and then you're putting it out in the world and hoping for the best. So there's, you know, there's a sort of a thick skin that you have to develop and that can be quite tough. And also just like, it's an industry, it's a business. You know, there's lots of business interests involved. There's lots of pitfalls that you can fall into. There's lots of things that are pulling your attention away from the love that you have for your music or the love that you have for performing or whatever. Like, and just finding a way to balance all those things, you know, travel, business, art, those three things have to kind of all be in place in a very specific kind of way to make it sustainable.
And life outside of it.
Exactly.
That's a fourth piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
Okay, so you referenced that you were a teen when you started writing and you knew that would be a part of your life. When was the transition to know, okay, now I'm going to be travel this path of becoming professional in it? And how did that those steps happen?
I started writing when I was like 12, 13, and I basically was just writing music that I felt connected to. It wasn't something that I really intended to release, or, you know, there was no like thought about this is going to be my first album or this like my, you know, I was just writing music. And then when I was like, I did that for like 3-4 years, played a few gigs in with high school bands, and, you know, I just kind of like immersed myself in music as much as I could during high school. Eventually I kind of plucked up the courage to like play the music for like friends and family and stuff. My dad and my friends and like some musician people in my life like were really impressed with some of the stuff that I'd written. So I ended up going into a little studio with my sound engineer, Vernie Schultz, who's been with me since the beginning, literally. And I recorded these little acoustic guitar demos where I just like kind of played acoustic guitar and I sang into the mic and put a little song idea down. Anyway, long story short, like those demos found their way to David Gresham Records, who then ended up signing me based on those demos I went back into studio and, you know, first time ever with like a proper producer and a proper studio and a house band of musicians. And we like really, you know, made the songs come to life. And that album did really well for me. And it was all a very like surprising and inspiring and you know, kind of terrifying experience, because I was so fresh, man. You know, I didn't really know anything at that point. I mean, I'd obviously seen my dad, but I've never been in that position. And so it happened quite fast for me, and that first album went platinum, you know, within like 2 years. You know, it was like a really big album. You know, I still wasn't 100% sure if I was going to be a musician even throughout that whole process. So I ended up doing a BA law degree and honors degree in English literature.
Oh, wow.
while doing that album and the album after that, yeah. So I still had backup plans.
Understanding your dad, Johnny, for the listeners, Johnny Clegg, JC's dad, being in the industry, was there any resistance from your side to actually play those songs initially to the friends and family? You were like, ooh, was there any sort of imposter syndrome? Will this be good enough? Will there be comparisons? Was any of that playing in your head? Or
yeah, definitely, man. I mean, it was that's also why it was terrifying. You know, I think at that age, you know, 18, 19, you know, you really are trying to figure yourself out. You know, there's so much of your own identity that you're trying to like establish. And it was a strange experience to kind of suddenly be thrust out into the sort of limelight or the public, still trying to work myself out and also having this other comparison. And there was, you know, there's just no escape. There's no escaping the legacy and people's preconceptions about what your music should sound like or what it could sound like or who this person is, you know. So, you know, luckily for me, I really always felt incredibly supported by my family. I have a great manager who really understood that very well. And I, you know, I just had a lot of good support. It still was challenging, man. I had to like go through a long period of like basically just like proving myself. You know, just like saying like, you know, I'm not just a flash in the pan kind of gimmick guy. Like I'm here to stay and I love what I do and I'm going to just keep doing it. And people are either with me or not, you know. And I mean, one of the things that I did, which I think really benefited me, was that, you know, for the first like 10 years of my career, like me and my dad didn't do anything together. Like we didn't perform together. We didn't appear together. Like we were so close. Like we, you know, he was like my best friend. We were like very deeply close, but we just kept our careers very separate. And I think that made a big difference.
But I mean, whether you've got a person talking generally about any artist, whether they've got a legacy of a parent or family member who's been in the industry or not, anyone has to prove themselves to say, okay,
So, absolutely. I mean, every artist has the challenge of who they are and the music that they make. And we all have to overcome that in some way. I was just kind of fighting a battle on two fronts at some point. But, you know, I think, I guess like the lesson that my dad's life is really a testament to is making the music you love no matter what is going on around you, you know. I had this amazing example of like, you know, there's just like a stamina that an artist gets where it's just like you just keep going, you know. It really is a marathon, and there's so much joy to feeling like you're like feeling those muscles start developing and flexing those muscles and finding that the moment you put a song out, you're excited for the next one and you're always writing and there's always creation happening and it's happening despite whatever career stuff is going on and whatever other things are happening. You're always connected to your music. Like that sort of undistracted attention that you can give to your music. Once you find that connection, I think you become kind of immune to all that stuff.
When you started, having been an observer of your father, and when you started, yes, you said you were terrified, et cetera, et cetera. Were there any elements that you were surprised about that are part of the journey and part of the process compared to being an observer pre to that? Besides the travel and all those different things, was there anything?
Like doing it myself?
Yes.
I think all of it was quite surprising, especially because it was like, it happened very quickly for me. Like, you know, I remember my first single came out and, you know, I was on the way to do my first interview, which I remember was 947. And it was the first time, like, they had this little weekend show, which was like a local music interview show. Yeah. And it was like my first time ever doing that. And I did this interview. And in the interview, as it started, the interviewer told me that the song had been playlisted on radio and it was on the chart. And it was number one on the chart. And I was like, really? I was just like, this is so strange. Like, this song came out like a few weeks ago. How is that possible? Like, it was a very pleasant surprise, obviously. Yeah. And, but it was also just like, wow, this is like, I just remember feeling like genuinely surprised.
Okay.
And then, I mean, look, it took me a long time to feel comfortable on stage. You know, like, I really am like a songwriter. You know, like, I my first two albums, I literally was sitting on my bed with an acoustic guitar and I wrote all the music, like everything. You know, the inward looking, like creative process of songwriting, I felt very comfortable with. But shifting to performance, which is very extrovert and very much like connecting with a big audience and being entertaining and observable and relatable, you know, like that side of it took me a long time. You know, that my sort of skill set at the beginning was very much songwriting. Yeah, that took me time to find my groove and find like what was comfortable for me.
You've referenced that for the first couple of albums you created on your bed. That is that still the same way you create now? Has it changed any way? Do you collaborate with others? Let's unpack your creative journey or process. How has it changed over time?
Yeah, it's changed a lot. I mean, I really loved the sort of very personal deep dive that songwriting was in the beginning for me. It just, I think I needed to do that to figure out who I was as an artist. Like, I think I think that was a very valuable time that I spent, just me, myself, and my music. Now I very much have been enjoying collaborating. You know, the collaborative experience is amazing. Like, I, you know, my this last sort of body of work, I've been basically recording in New York and LA with loads of different producers, different musicians, other songwriters, friends. And I've found that like it's a nice way to push yourself out of your comfort zone all the time. Like you never feel like you know what's going to happen in a songwriting session. It also like challenges you to expand your own horizons and push yourself in terms of what kind of artist you can be. You know, I've experimented now with like hip hop and R&B, and you know, I've really moved away from my like sort of rock guitar based roots. You know, very, very few of my newer songs even have any guitar on it. And that's been like a really fun and challenging experience. And I think like as a solo artist, I don't have a band of musicians with me. And so I have to create scenarios where I feel inspired and where I feel challenged and just kind of trust my gut on where the music's going. You know, I think that it's taken me a long time to get to that point where I can like really just dive into any room and work with anyone and we can write songs, like let's go. And I love that process. It's like one of the great joys of my time as a musician. It's just writing with different people and experimenting. And, you know, there's nothing more thrilling than like walking into a room with an absolute blank canvas. There's no music that exists yet.
Yeah.
And you walk in and a few hours later you walk out and there's a finished song with a storyline and a concept and an emotion. And that's just so thrilling.
When you're creating with people, producers, writers that you've never created before, the first time, is it that scenario of you go in and dive in straight away, or does it take a moment for you two guys to get used to each other, trust each other before opening that vulnerability?
You know, songwriting is so difficult. It is such a difficult thing, for me at least. Like, it's very hard to like define a process. You know, I've had songs where I write them from beginning to end. The entire song just falls out in 5 minutes. And there's other songs that have taken me 2 years to finish. I think the most important thing is to just feel relaxed and playful, curious about where the song can go. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I often like to have a conversation with whoever's in the studio that day. It's nice to just like, before you even start playing anything, like just talk, be vulnerable with each other. Like you're gonna be creative. You have to reveal something about yourself. You have to open up in a way. And that is it's a beautiful experience, but it's an act of trust.
Yeah.
And you have to trust the person there that they're gonna catch you, you know, and also have something to add and bring you back to, you know, the thread of the song. Like there's lots of like little things that come together for a great collaboration to work. And it's also always terrifying. You know, like every time you walk in, I've written thousands of songs, and every time I go into studio, there's always like that little what's going to happen? I have no idea. Maybe I'm never going to write a song again. Like there's always that, which is also exhilarating. In terms of like process, I guess it's just like walking in, connecting with the people in the room, playing some music, keys, guitar, whatever it might be. And then I usually just start with melody. Like for me, melody is the thing that I always latch onto, and the music and the melody suggests the lyrics. Like the emotion of what's happening in the room, the lyrics emerge in time. you have to be patient.
To be patient. That's a lesson that I always need to learn as well in different scenarios.
Yeah.
So you reference lyrics, emotion. So I'm going into the space. I'm not sure if you're aware of NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. So that's the way people process information.
Mm.
As part of that thought process, there's sort of a subsection of process skills. Now, each of us have a dominant one, a secondary, and tertiary. Now, dominant means we'll be in it most of the day, secondary maybe a couple of hours, tertiary half an hour, if at all. Something kicks into each of us as a child that allows us to perceive that we need to be dominant in that skill. Now, the three process skills are visual. So visual people create pictures of the information they're receiving. So as I'm talking now, visual people sort of create a picture in their mind. Audio people or auditory people is about the words, understanding the word, putting the word into a sentence, understanding the sentence. Kinesthetic, that word again, kinesthetic is they receive the information and then they process on body language, tone of voice, emotions, feelings, and so forth.
Mm.
So now focusing specifically on music, because it may overlap or be different in areas of your life. When you're listening to a finished song of your soul, of your own, or of another artist, are you creating pictures? Is it about the lyrics? Is it about the feeling of the song?
Jeez, I mean, I think like if it's my own music, I'm trying to reconnect with the feeling, especially like if you're recording over many months, you know, the thing that you're trying to hold on to is like, what was the feeling okay. of the song? Like, what was the memory or what was the interaction that I was talking about? Or what is this thing trying to pinpoint? You know, it's nice to get like really accurate with that and like let that be the thing that comes across very strongly. I mean, obviously I'm listening to the music and I'm listening to all the little like textures of the sounds and how do they resonate with this emotion. I got, for me, it always comes back to the emotion.
The emotion. Okay.
Like, is this synth sound bringing us back to what the world of this feeling?
Okay, got
and
it.
Is the, are the drums bringing us back? Like every single thing filters back to like, okay. does this work conceptually for the emotion of the song? I think that's probably how I understand it. I mean, it's an interesting way to filter, you know, an art experience through. I also think like linguistically, you know, like I was thinking about this the other day, like, you know, writing lyrics. I studied like English literature, you know, so I've read so much poetry and, you know, beautiful old classic novels, and you know, you can read words on a page and they sound beautiful and they work internally, the rhyme structure, the rhythm all connects to itself, and there's like a mathematics in how that the poetry works and how, or literature. But with writing lyrics, you can have a perfectly mathematically correct poem that just doesn't sing well. Like, you just can't okay. sing those syllables. It's the exact right amount of syllables. Yeah, everything yeah. works, but it just doesn't sound good to sing. So there's this other factor that you have to like keep coming back to
yeah, yeah.
when you're writing lyrics, which is like, you know, there's a musicality to language. Like every language has its own internal musicality.
Yes.
How words sound, how they land on your ear. Hard phrases and, you know, the jagged words. When you sing those words, even though you're talking about something beautiful, there's like an edginess to how they sound. You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
There's just like this very, there's like an emotional world of like how the sounds land beyond what the words mean, which is like another layer of songwriting, which I think I have a connection to that. So I like how that works as well. Like, so I guess it all comes back to the feeling, but there's always like these other things at play.
So now, having studied English literature, has that enhanced or helped you with your writing of songs, or is it completely separate?
No, definitely. Okay. It's helped me massively. I think just vocab, like just having a wider vocabulary
yeah.
is just more tools in the toolbox. Like having a little bit of training in terms of like how to say something, like keep bringing the point back to the foundation of what the message is.
Yes.
Like let it keep filtering back to that. Like how to not get too distracted from the core message. And you know, you can write in the most beautiful way, but if it starts losing track in terms of the thread, I think that's been very helpful. And you know, just reading beautiful literature, like that's yeah. just inspiring, you know.
Yeah.
Like it just blew my mind.
I love reading books. So many, you speak to people these days and like, books, what is that?
Yeah, I wish I still read as much as I did, man. I mean, geez, I was reading like, I mean, you know, when you're doing postgrad, like you're reading a book a week, you know, and it's like hard books, like really long
yeah.
18th century yes, romanticism and stuff. Like it's, you know, I was really in that vibe for a while.
So you referenced it took you a while to get used to performing on stage, the more extrovert type of elements and those getting into that groove. Was there any specific thing that clicked into place that you're like, ah, now I understand? Or was it just a situation of doing it more and more and more over time that allowed you to get into that rhythm?
Yeah, I think like it took me a long time. I mean, you know, I think like performing is really about creating a mood and an energy that the audience can respond to.
Yep.
And I was like really focused on the writing and really focused on like making the music good, and everything else felt like an afterthought. And as I've grown up, I think that I've done a lot more performing. So I know yeah. like there's a little bit of experience now that I can like draw on, you know, if something goes wrong or if there's things that are unexpected, I kind of can handle all that stuff. You know, I'm more experienced as a musician, like just the confidence that you need to like go onto any stage and perform. Another factor is just like having proved myself for all these years. You know,
yeah.
you feel like you can come on stage and claim that space. That's been really helpful to me. You know, like I feel like I've earned my place, and I'm grateful to be here still after all these years. And I just want to like enjoy the work that I've made with people who want to hear it. And like, just like simplifying all that stuff, you know, you can really overthink this stuff.
Yes, yes, I know.
You can really come on stage with so many thoughts and doubts and fears. And, you know, there's so many technical things that can go wrong. And, you know, there's a lot of the time, even on the best shows, something is happening on stage that like no one expected.
Yeah.
And you just have to like roll with the punches.
Let it go. Yeah.
Yeah. And you realize that like, I think the biggest revelation for me was just like, music live is not the same as music in studio.
Yes.
Like the detail oriented, like really hyper focused, like, you know, micromanaging each detail of like what a piece of music sounds like is not the same as going on stage and playing the show. And like people are experiencing whatever they want from that song. And like the sound doesn't work on the side of the stage.
Yeah.
And the bass amp isn't work, like, you know, and we're still having a great time because the energy's there and the concept of the song works and people love it. And there's just, you know, we're all in this organic, temporary experience together, and whatever ends up coming out of the speakers is what the song was, and that, and just accepting that.
So, okay, so I'm that dude that's normally right up in front. I'll take my phone out for a couple of photos, a couple of videos, and then I put it away.
Mm.
I notice these days a lot of times, oftentimes, especially near the front, people are videoing and posting and tweeting for a lot of time of the show.
Yeah.
For the person on the stage, when you were referencing energy, do you not find that takes away from the energy, or is it just where society is at the moment?
Look, I'm kind of guilty of that too, to be honest. Like if I'm seeing an artist that I really want to see, I like to film it just, and I never watch those videos. I don't know. It is kind of sad. You know, it's like you're watching the show through your phone.
Mm.
And if you just did that, it's like the most 4K,
yes,
like HD experience you're going to have. So yeah, there is something strange about that. I mean, I definitely notice it more with younger audiences.
Yes.
I've played festivals where like almost everyone has a phone. I think that like it's also a signifier that people are enjoying it, like they want to capture it. I mean, I know for myself, if I'm filming something, I'm like, man, this is dope. I really want to capture this. So I try to take it as a compliment.
So what's coming up for the rest of this year?
Okay, so I've got loads of new music coming out. I am going back to the States in March for some shows, playing in New York again. I've got a lot of exciting collaborations coming out. Msaki and I are working on an album together. I've got some house tracks coming out with some cool DJs I'm really psyched about. And yeah, man, I've got just lots of new music and doing the show thing, touring and stuff. Everything, all my dates are on my website, jessiclegg.com. And I'm excited to share all the new music.
Love me a CD. I still budget my CDs every month. For me, it's an energy exchange for you guys to say thank you for all the
I don't know where you're buying CDs, though.
Wait. Okay, wait. So, obviously, you're not aware. So, overseas, CDs, vinyls, and cassettes are a massive comeback. Last year alone in the UK, 5.9 million vinyls sold in the UK, the biggest since 1990.
Yeah, vinyls, but
no,
CDs.
No, CDs, as well, because in the UK as well, they've got a basket of products where they gauge exchanges. And based on those exchanges, it's some tax element. I'm not exactly sure. And because of the upsurge of CDs, that product is now back in that basket. Vinyl's been in it for the longest time. And the research is showing that it's the younger people, the teenagers, the early 20s who are diving into that world, not the older nostalgia people. Yes, obviously in South Africa where there's not many places to get them. But, you know, if you go overseas, there's HMV and Tower Records and all those places where you can have that immersive experience of choosing and that journey. But again, then we've got these digital platforms that people consume music on. What are your observations of the landscape at the moment?
Look, I think that there's pros and cons. You know, I think what has been exciting for me is feeling like I have a direct relationship with people who want to hear my music. Like I can put something out and there's no middleman that's going to tell me I can't. Like I can do whatever I want. I can put a song out tomorrow, you know, and I can market that song myself. I can do everything. And it's just a direct relationship. And that feels, that's quite new actually in the industry. Like there was always a label, an agent, you know, there was always these like big corporate entities that kind of made sure these artists are being prioritized. And, but that said, I'm also an established artist. And I think that for new artists, it's very difficult, man. And you know, there's like 100,000 songs coming out on Spotify like every single day.
Exactly.
And it's beautiful that it's been democratized to the extent that it has, that everyone has the chance to make a song and put it out and have the same shot that Beyonce has. You can, like, those two artists can coexist on the same platform and, and are just as accessible. But there is so much music. And I think as a consumer, you just don't know where to start. And so, like, you know, for new artists, they still rely on the old gatekeepers. So it hasn't really solved that problem for newer artists. I think that there are some amazing stories of, like, breakout artists that just, like, recorded something in their bedroom, put it out, and they hit the lottery on the internet, you know. I don't think that's very common. I don't think you can, like, bet on that. I think that's a once-in-a-lifetime kind of thing. And I also think that, like, the business model is just horrendous, especially for songwriters, man. If you're not, like, if you're not the performing artist, if you're not able to, like, monetize your music through live and through merchandise and branding and sponsor, all those other things that come with being the front-facing artist,
yeah.
If you're just the songwriter in the back end, songwriters are just not being paid what they used to get paid because there's just less money in music consumption outside of live music. There's aspects of it that are genuinely concerning and potentially unsustainable. And there's a lot of lawsuits that are pending, especially in the States, to try and, like, reevaluate how these massive Silicon Valley companies are basically exploiting creators, you know, because YouTube, Spotify, Apple, all these platforms, like, there's all this content, but someone is making that content and it's not for free. You know, there's exactly. People who are making content and the consumer's consuming it for free, and there's a middle entity that is facilitating that interaction. And yeah, so there's been this, like, strange deprioritizing of the creator just in terms of the business model, and I think that that's a worry. And there's amazing advantages that come with having the access, but there's also people that have been left behind. And I remember when my first album came out, this was probably the last moment that album sales were still a big thing, and I didn't really need to play shows. Like, I had, like, my album sales were my main source of income.
Yes.
And now it's completely flipped on its head. You know, you have much more listeners, but, you know, you just can't, there's no way to monetize it. So it's a very strange moment.
Yes.
I think that artists, we need to solve the problem. And I think it is moving in the right direction. Yes. And I think that art and creatives should try and take control back, because it is a scary situation where it's not even a human being curating what we see anymore in terms of art. It's an algorithm.
Yeah.
And I mean, back in the day with the labels, like, there was still an A&R person. There was still someone who was, like, had their ear to the ground listening to, like, what is important? Who's making music that is challenging and interesting and that, like, we haven't heard before? Like, there was a human being looking for that music. Whether they were, like, right or wrong, like, at least it was human beings. Now it's like there's, you know, algorithms are doing that at a mass scale. And it's mostly doing, you know, AI is very derivative. So it's gonna take what it knows has already worked and just give you more of that.
Exactly.
So you're never gonna really discover something, like, completely different, like, completely artistically challenging. Like, you're never gonna find that on your, like, reels or on your storyline. Because the algorithm doesn't want to take that risk. Whereas if there's independent labels and there's A&R people and they're just like, this is the coolest thing on earth, we need to get this out, no matter what people think, that kind of edginess and, like, ability for art to, like, reinvent itself, I worry that maybe that's – we're losing that. And I think that people are becoming more aware and, like, the situation is changing, but it's a strange moment we're in.
Now, I love this game. I know if I had to ask you this question in 2 minutes, 10 years, 5 hours, I know your answer will be different every time. I understand that and I recognize that. I'm not saying favorite. I'm saying top of mind. If you had to push play to 5 songs once you finish the conversation on the way home by other artists, who would those 5 songs be and by whom? And if you can't think of specific songs, just 5 artists off the top of your head.
Oh, man. Okay. At the moment, this is not my all-time favorite. This
no, it must be my favorite.
I'm literally thinking about what I would be listening to.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
I've discovered a band that is actually very well known, but I just had never listened to them, called TV on the Radio. I just think they're amazing, and they've been going for like 25 years, and I've never heard their music before. So I just discovered them like 2 days ago, and I was so impressed. So I'm listening to that. I went to go see a friend of mine's show recently. His name is Muzi. He's one of the most amazing artists in South Africa, like maybe the most. And I'm just such a fan of his, so I've just been listening to his music. I'm really loving a Cape Town band called Internet Girl. I think they're brilliant. I think they're going to blow up. Who else? I wish I could look at my phone right now.
Two more.
Okay. I've been listening to a little bit of Block Party for some reason. I haven't listened to them in years, and I just decided to listen to them recently. And I went to a festival on the weekend, like a Afro House festival, and I watched a whole bunch of artists. So I got to see DJ Lag for the first time, and I'm just a big fan of his, so I've been listening to DJ Lag.
Okay, cool. So the podcast is listened to throughout the world. As a final message, what would you like to say?
I guess I am so excited to share new music with everyone listening today, and I hope that it finds its way into everyone's algorithm. And, like, you know, just keep listening to interesting, weird music. Like, I just hope everyone keeps doing that. Like, it is the thing that keeps music growing and keep evolving and keeps it beautiful. So, more weird music in the world.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.